Have you ever heard of a rain tax? This is the Allegheny Front. Charging people for rainwater that runs off driveways and rooftops is one way local communities are trying to keep rivers clean. Impressions of the idea are mixed.
We don't need another bill. We have enough.
I would support any measure that helps develop the infrastructure and limits any sort of pollution that goes into the river waters.
That's today on the Allegheny Front as our series Ripple Effects continues, looking at new solutions to water pollution. Plus, Pennsylvania's big Supreme Court decision on fracking and Pittsburgh's new mayor promises sustainability. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. Please stay tuned to the Allegheny Front.
I, William Peduto, do solemnly swear.
Pittsburgh got a new mayor this week, and his first official address was music to the ears of environmentalists. Longtime Democratic councilman Bill Peduto gave his inauguration speech indoors, since temperatures had hovered around zero and below. In the speech, he said his agenda for the future would be broken up into three categories.
Accountability, responsibility, and sustainability.
Peduto described sustainability as creating a lasting culture of governance that makes a city's economy expand and thrive.
And all the while, guarding the land, the waters, and the sky, which we share with the rest of the world.
The 49-year-old Peduto has been a friend to the environmental movement throughout his time on the council. He wrote bills that were enacted to reduce air pollution and provided incentives for green buildings. In past interviews, Peduto has said that his plan for environmental policy as mayor is to rework the city's zoning code to promote energy savings in buildings. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. This is the Allegheny Front. Well, since the weather's warmed up a bit, you may have already forgotten about the blast of Arctic air earlier in the week. The media picked up on the term polar vortex, and the question of climate change swirled through the news cycle. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant has more.
It's been a week of whiplash weather, with temperatures in the mid-50s this weekend, just days after record-breaking cold in much of the country. The polar vortex brought temperatures 30 to 50 degrees below what's typical in many places. Schools were canceled because such low temperatures could be dangerous. Conservative talk show host Rush Limbaugh said the term polar vortex was a hoax cooked up by liberals to serve their global warming agenda. Limbaugh was lambasted by everyone from Forbes magazine to Slate.com to Al Roker. The nation's most famous TV weatherman pulled out an old textbook showing that polar vortex is a legitimate term that's been around for decades. It's where the Arctic air resides, generally around the polar regions. But the question remains, was man-made climate change to blame for the bitter cold?
Yeah, at this point, this is early research, and it is just a theory. It's not widely accepted.
That's Jeff Masters. He's meteorologist at the popular website Weather Underground and has been quoted all over the place this week. He explains that much of the U.S. got an Arctic blast because of an unusual movement of the jet stream. The jet stream normally flows west to east. It acts as a barrier, locking seriously cold air into the polar regions and keeping it away from most of the U.S. But as the Arctic ice melts and northern temperatures heat up, there's less of a temperature difference between the far north and the U.S.
And when you don't have a stronger temperature difference, you don't require the wind to blow as strongly to try and equalize the temperature difference and the pressure difference that exists between the two locations. So now the jet stream isn't constrained to flow very fast west to east. It can kind of slow down, take big meandering loops.
Master says last week the jet stream dipped down to the south, making way for that Arctic air to blast the U.S. Some scientific journals, such as Oceanography, have already published papers on this theory, but Master says there needs to be more research before climate change can be blamed for the southern movement of the polar vortex. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
From snowy weather to something called a rain tax that's meant to help with water pollution. Julie Grant will be back later in the show. Please stay tuned to the Allegheny Front. Not so fast. That was the resounding answer that Pennsylvania's Supreme Court recently gave to Act 13, the state's landmark oil and gas drilling law passed in 2012. The justices' 4-2 decision threw not just a monkey wrench into Governor Corbett's signature legislation, legal experts say it may have done a lot more damage. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier is here to break it down for us. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Jennifer.
So, Reed, let's just jump into it. What did the Supreme Court say about Act 13?
So three justices said that this act violated the Pennsylvania Environmental Rights Amendment, that basically this was taking away from our right to a clean environment. A fourth justice used another rationale to find that Act 13 was unconstitutional. One of the most controversial portions of Act 13 was that it took away the local municipality's right to zone against shale drilling. The municipality couldn't say, well, this is a residential neighborhood. We really don't allow that kind of activity here. Act 13 said the municipalities can't tell the oil and gas companies where to drill. A lower court and now the Supreme Court both said that's not actually constitutional, that the state can't ban local zoning for shale gas drilling.
Now, the next step, I guess, is that this case goes back down to the lower court to decide if other provisions of the law should stand.
That's right. So what we could be looking at is just a pared-down version of Act 13, but right now, things like the impact fee that are collected on a per-well basis are still standing. Now, the Corbett administration has asked the Supreme Court to reconsider parts of this decision. Legal experts say this is highly unlikely that the Supreme Court would revisit the 162-page lead decision that it just came out with and three other opinions. But I guess Corbett...
Doesn't hurt to ask.
Doesn't hurt to ask. That's right.
So has drilling screeched to a halt anywhere because of this?
Absolutely not. So drilling and the permitting of wells will still go on. The local zoning against shale drilling or over shale drilling, you know, most of this drilling is happening in places where that's not even applicable. What you may end up seeing is that townships and boroughs could, you know, enact stronger controls over drilling in their boundaries. But what's going to happen long term with some of the rationale that the Supreme Court used? Now, that is where we could see some major changes, not just in the years to come, but in the decades to come.
And that rationale had to do with something known as the Environmental Rights Amendment, which I would venture to say a lot of us hadn't heard much about in recent years.
That's right. It was actually an amendment ratified by voters in 1971. It was passed twice in both houses of the legislature with unanimous support. No one ever voted against this amendment. And basically, it guarantees everyone in Pennsylvania clean air and pure water. And essentially, the Supreme Court and courts in Pennsylvania had essentially ignored this amendment whenever it came up. And the plaintiffs argued that this Act 13 was violating that very core right of everyone to a clean environment. And actually, when the plaintiffs brought this up with people that were advising them, they said, you know, you're crazy. And in fact, I spoke with one of the people that advised the plaintiffs. His name's Bruce Ledowitz. He's a Duquesne law professor. And here's what he said about the amendment, which is actually Article 1, Section 27 of the Pennsylvania Constitution.
And when they told me that they intended to rely on Section 27, I told them that that was a waste of their time, that it didn't mean anything.
You said don't bother.
Yes, absolutely.
But they bothered with it.
Oh, yeah. And they sure were right.
And this has been surprising to people paying attention to this case, this use of the Environmental Rights Amendment in this decision about Act 13.
Absolutely. This could have major repercussions in not just oil and gas, but any kind of development that impacts the environment. One obvious area could be real estate, where if you want to cut down a forest to build a subdivision somewhere, somebody could throw up an objection over this environmental rights amendment.
So I understand that there was some really strong wording from these justices who sided together in the plurality decision.
That's right. They really took exception to what they saw as a sort of environmental degradation that they wrote would happen as a result of this law. And in fact, I'll read just one example of this. They said, by any responsible account, the exploitation of the Marcellus Shale formation will produce a detrimental effect on the environment.
Wow.
I spoke with an energy lawyer about this. He said that when he read this statement, it literally took his breath away. He said, this is still a question that scientists, government, regulators are trying to grapple with. Is fracking safe? And that it's exceedingly rare for the Supreme Court to kind of hop in on this kind of argument and make a declaration that on one side or the other.
Let's take a step back in history, if you want to. Where did this amendment come from?
So this amendment came about in the early 70s, and I tracked down the lawmaker who wrote the amendment. His name's Franklin Curry, and he's from North Central Pennsylvania. He said he wrote the law because of the state's long history of environmental degradation from steel, but also, especially in his area of the state, coal. And here's what he said about it.
I was very angry and upset with what the coal companies had done to exploit Pennsylvania's natural resource, particularly in northeastern Pennsylvania. They really ravished the land. They took the money out and left many miles of acid mine drainage polluted water.
He says he's proud that something that he wrote 40 years ago is still being talked about and is still relevant.
And it's finally getting its day in court, it would seem.
It certainly is.
Reed Frazier, thanks for the history lesson and the latest news in fracking.
Thanks.
With the Allegheny Front, I'm Jennifer Shveta Jordan.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Center for Environmental Research and Education at Duquesne University. The center is hosting an open house on Thursday, February 6th for prospective students. The center provides multidisciplinary education for careers in environmental science and management with opportunities for research and internships. Programs include a BS in environmental science, master's in environmental science and management, and professional certificates. More information on the Center for Environmental Research and Education is at duq.edu/ESM.
The federal government is toughening limits on how much stormwater can enter rivers and lakes. Cities need to keep it from running directly off rooftops and streets into the waterways. It's proving expensive, especially in older communities where water pipes are crumbling and in need of repair. To fix those systems, local governments need money, and some are starting to charge residents a stormwater utility fee. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant visited one Pennsylvania city that recently started what some call a rain tax. It's part of our continuing reporting series, Ripple Effects.
There's a big hole in the street in the small downtown of Meadville, 40 miles south of Erie. More than 70 years ago, much of the city was built over the top of streams, which are enclosed in concrete tunnels called culverts. Assistant City Manager Andy Walker says last summer when Meadville got hit with a huge rainstorm, one of the major tunnels clogged.
Essentially, the culvert became nearly completely plugged with sediment and debris, rocks, branches, some from the storm itself, and frankly, from other probably prior events where we hadn't done proper maintenance.
A third of the downtown streets flooded. Cars couldn't get through. The water gushed over and under the roads with so much force, iron manhole covers were pushed up more than 6 feet off the ground. 6 months later, Meadville is still recovering. Walker stands by the hole on Market Street. He says the city had to dig up the street to get to the underground tunnel. Then they had to figure out how to remove the branches and rocks that were plugging it up.
And this is where we had opened it up to literally drag out the debris, and we had a pulley system and dragging a bucket so that we can get it to this hole and then scoop it out with a traditional backhoe and load it out.
The $150,000 price tag may not sound bad, but for a small city like Meadville, it's a significant portion of the budget. Thankfully, Walker says they don't have to spend money from the general fund. Last year, Meadville started charging residents a stormwater utility fee to pay for maintenance and for projects like this. Many call it a rain tax, but Walker doesn't like that term.
And in fact, we try not to call it a tax increase because it is really a user fee.
Walker says like any other utility, water or sewer, people are billed by how much they use it. In the case of a stormwater fee, property owners are charged based on the footage of impervious surfaces such as parking lots and rooftops on their property. He says rainwater runs off of those surfaces and into the public stormwater system.
Depending on the size of your parcel, that's your billing unit, that's your impact, that's your usage of the system, and you're billed accordingly then.
Last January, the average homeowner started paying a new fee, about $90 per year in Meadville. Cities such as Philadelphia and Mount Lebanon, south of Pittsburgh, have started charging similar fees. More Pittsburgh area municipalities are expected to start considering a stormwater fee this year. We asked a few residents about it at a drugstore on the East End. Matt Marquette is a lawyer and a homeowner on the East End.
I would support any measure that helps develop the infrastructure and limits any sort of pollution that goes into the river waters, which I think are a great local resource.
But others we asked don't want a stormwater fee. In the greeting card aisle, Cheryl Fuller stopped to disparage the idea.
We don't need another bill. We have enough. As homeowners, gas, light, water, sewage, and now a sewer fee? No. No. It's time to become a renter.
The state of Maryland recently passed the country's first statewide stormwater fee. It's expected to cost the average homeowner around $175 a year.
Taxing rainwater. I know it sounds crazy, but that's exactly what the state of Maryland is doing, creating a flood of outrage.
That's Jerry Willis on Fox News. Her guest is a county executive from Maryland, Laura Newman.
So essentially, the amount of rainwater that is outplaced by my structure, my building, my house, I get taxed for that. Is that the way it works?
That's the idea. They're thinking that the amount of impervious surface on your property, meaning your roof, your driveway, your home, will determine the amount of tax that you pay.
I'm telling you, that sounds like a ton of dough. I mean,
well,
I can
imagine. It is.
Newman says the stormwater fee is expected to raise $14 billion by 2025 in Maryland. It won't raise near that much in Meadville, PA, but it's still a lot of money for some businesses and large property owners to pay. Cliff Willis is director of the physical plant at Hilly Allegheny College. Its stormwater utility bill was $70,000 last year. He says not everyone understands why they're being forced to pay for runoff from their parking lots and rooftops.
In any community, particularly a small community, you'll have folks grumbling about additional fees and having to, well, we're just going to move outside the city limits then.
Willis says there is significant development in a nearby township outside Meadville city limits. He says township residents don't pay for police, fire, or stormwater services. But as a former municipal engineer himself, Willis supports the new fee.
I've been here for about 5.5 years, and on at least two occasions, I've seen water running down Main Street deeper than 6 inches. So, yes, there certainly is a need for stormwater management.
Meadville has already spent some of the money mapping its stormwater lines. And when a sinkhole appeared in one homeowner's backyard because of an old line, the city had the $60,000 it needed to build a new one. Meadville's Andy Walker says even with the money from the fee, they can't fix all the problems. He says when 2 inches of rain fell in less than 2 hours last summer, some people wanted the city to clean up water in their homes.
You know, we're sort of demanding action now that they're paying the stormwater fee, and I had to explain to them that, you know, of a storm of that size, no matter what we did, you know, we almost couldn't throw enough money at the problem to fix and prepare for that size event.
Pennsylvania already has a lot of rain and snow, and climate scientists predict larger storms in the coming years. Walker says even with the new fee, fixing the overloaded stormwater system is going to take decades. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
You can find all of the stories in our series on water pollution and new solutions at alleghenyfront.org/ripple effect.
Ripple Effects is funded by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds and Think Outside the Pipes, a local reporting initiative funded by the Park Foundation and sponsored by Penn State Public Media and its Water Blues Green Solutions documentary.
When you listen to the Allegheny Front, you're in good company.
Hi, I'm Linda Sparr from Indiana, Pennsylvania, and I listen to the Allegheny Front every week because the stories are just so amazing.
Hi, this is Rick Seaback. I make TV programs at WQED, and I always listen to the Allegheny Front.
I'm Deanna Hitchcock from My Goodies Bakery, and I listen to the Allegheny Front on Saturday mornings when I'm baking.
Please consider making a donation to support our work by going to AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. We've been exploring new solutions to water pollution in our series, Ripple Effects. How to handle water problems is big business. Annual revenues in global water services are forecast to hit $1 trillion by 2020 as companies confront water scarcity. So a new organization called Water Economy Network wants to bring a cut of that financial pie here to Pittsburgh. Steve McKnight is a co-founder of the Water Economy Network. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Jennifer. How are you?
Okay. And I know you're on the phone from home in part today because of your own water problems. You started the day discovering frozen pipes in the house. So thanks for talking.
Oh, absolutely.
Do you have a 30-second kind of version of how you define the Water Economy Network?
Sure. The Water Economy Network is actually a group of industry leaders here within the Western Pennsylvania region, actually down into West Virginia and even parts of Ohio, that have come together really to take advantage of what is a major water market here in our region. We're a very water-rich area, but we have to also be very careful stewards of that resource.
Our region is one of the most reliable in the world in terms of water supply. The way water, our waterways, the Three Rivers, have been used in the past was not always to the benefit of the health of the environment or people. How do we get it right this time?
And that's a good question. You know, I think we have the benefit this time of technology. You know, when we look at the kinds of really unique and innovative ways that we're addressing some of our challenges, for instance, there's a company that's a spin out of Carnegie Mellon, which is called Platypus, which manufactures small remote control boats that have all types of sensors on them to monitor the water quality. The Port of Pittsburgh, this is really interesting. This is one of the premier sort of projects that the Water Economy Network is helping to implement, is the Port of Pittsburgh is pushing for a wireless waterway network. And essentially, if you can imagine, you know, your wireless hub that's in your home being extended down on all aspects of the riverfront, the riverfronts present some natural barriers to that type of technology occurring. So you really need to set up special sensors at a certain directional point to allow the information at the river level to be transmitted from that point to other locations. So the Port of Pittsburgh is leading a way to create, basically light up the river so we can begin to pull information from the river, use the sensors such as companies like Platypus that are out there, you know, running boats up and down the river and monitoring the water quality.
You are partnered, you mentioned, with Carnegie Mellon University, Consol Energy, as well as the Environmental Protection Agency. What do these organizations offer? Say Consol Energy.
Consol is an interesting company, an interesting partner. I mean, when we think of coal and we think of course, more commonly, when we think of natural gas now, we know that natural gas is using water in the fracking process. But, of course, coal historically, you know, has had challenges with acid mine drainage, so a lot of the old mines have filled up with water. Well, determining ways in which you can turn that water into an asset, clean it up and reuse it in different types of ways is something that's top of mind at Consol. So they offer a lot of type of test beds within their real estate holdings where innovative technologies can be platformed and demonstrated and taken up to potential market readiness.
When we think about water users, another thing, agriculture and energy are certainly on the list. How is the Water Economy Network helping in those areas?
Right. Well, when it comes to energy, I mean, there's a couple different ways to look at it. There's the consumption of energy that's required in the manufacturing process, and a lot of the larger energy producers, of course, are major users of water. So looking at different ways in which closed-loop systems and such can help feed energy power plants and looking at ways that that can be more efficiently done. We're partnering with all of the major universities in our region that have a special interest in those areas and also core expertise in those areas. So a lot of our energy sector is at a real advantage here when it comes to our university partnerships, and the Water Economy Network is helping to facilitate that. And, of course, the other examples that, you know, are getting the press nowadays really is the natural gas. So it's critical that we really take a look at the use of water in this process and how can it be better managed and maintained so we do get the benefit of the natural gas without putting the watershed at greater risk.
How can it? How do you do that?
It's a good question. I mean, there's lots of neutralizing technologies that are out there to take a look at how do you remove some of the bad chemicals that are in the water, and how do you manage that, the use of that water better. Is there ways in which you can use gray water or water that was formerly acid mine drainage water that can be cleaned up to a level and able to be used in the fracking process? These are all options that are on the table.
So in a week or so, you're launching a partnership with Idea Foundry in Pittsburgh, yep. which is a kind of startup launch pad with mentoring. And what you're doing with them is specifically for the water industry. Say more about that.
Yeah, so Innovate H2O is an accelerator program, innovation accelerator program, where the Water Economy Network is partnering with Idea Foundry, and Idea Foundry is leading that effort. So they have a lot of history and a lot of core expertise in helping to launch companies and start them and grow them. And so this is a particular accelerator program that's focused on different areas of the water economy, looking at areas like energy production, manufacturing, and navigation and monitoring, and the greening infrastructure. So there's going to be a call for innovation and ideas, and there's going to be an application process, which is going to be outlined when the project is launched, and awards will be made to those selected, and they'll have some funding available to them to help move their ideas to greater market readiness.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing how this all shakes out.
I appreciate it.
That was Steve McKnight, co-founder of the Water Economy Network, which is working to make Pittsburgh the Silicon Valley of water technology. This interview is part of our series Ripple Effects about water pollution and new solutions. You can find all our coverage at AlleghenyFront.org. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. This is the Allegheny Front.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from Table Magazine, sharing food, culture, and lifestyle in western Pennsylvania. The winter issue includes inspiring food gifts, tricks for hosting dinner parties of all sizes, and the best dark beers of the season. Table Magazine's winter issue is on newsstands now. More information is available at tablemagazine.com.
When the federal government started looking at sweeping new food safety regulations a few years ago, there was concern among smaller farmers who want to employ environmentally friendly practices. Now the Food and Drug Administration is taking a second look at what those farmers had to say. The Allegheny Front's Hal B. Klein has more.
Vegetables aren't supposed to make us sick, but after a number of serious food scares from spinach and peanut butter, Congress demanded more accountability from farmers and passed the Food Safety Modernization Act. Brian Snyder, president of the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture, says that some of the proposed rules were unfair to small farmers, and since they have yet to take effect, they made their voices heard.
What we did and what a number of organizations across the country did was to motivate farmers to get up to speed on the regulations so that we could kind of get ahead of it and prevent some of this unintended consequences from happening.
For example, one rule regulated the use of fresh manure and compost on farms, and another required the detailed testing of water. Snyder says that these rules make sense for big farms, but they're expensive and not necessary for small farms.
It often is much more difficult for farmers who are just figuring out things on a local level to deal with regulations the bigger companies have people on staff to deal with.
Snyder says that the regulations could force small farmers out of business or cause them to rely on more conventional but less environmentally friendly farming techniques. Based on these concerns, the FDA is revisiting its proposed rules. Snyder says that he and others are in talks with regulators, and they're hoping that the concerns of small farmers are addressed once the rules are finalized next year. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Hal B. Klein.
Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is our executive producer. Carol Holsapple is our digital editor and production director. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. Please join us again next week for more environmental news around your home on the Allegheny Front.
The Allegheny Front is supported by the Heinz Endowments and the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of Marcellus Shale, energy, and conservation issues.